If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis, and it's very appropriate that this week we have been talking about WGN-TV possibly broadcasting some baseball games again, because this is a historic week. Anna?
This will be, yeah, Bob, that I know a lot of talk about that going on right now across the city, and this will take you back to the very beginning of it all. Television history was made this week in 1948, April 16th, when WGN-TV broadcast its first Cubs game. That was just a few weeks after WGN-TV signed on the air. Such a moment in time, really. Jack Brickhouse was calling the crosstown Cubs-Sox exhibition game at Wrigley. It was the beginning of a seven-decade-plus partnership. And not an exaggeration, I think, to say that WGN Cubs broadcasts just created generations of fans, not only in Chicago, but outside when it became a superstation. You know, they were just kind of getting used to live sports. This is the very beginning. We pulled a clip here because you'll take a look here because WGN, or let's take a listen, I should say. WGN took a look back at the early days of television, and they put together sort of a montage here that producer Joe put together for us.
There's a drive on the line to left field. Come on, Moose! He did it! It's a no-hitter! A no-hitter!
Ladies and gentlemen, we have just been informed that this baseball game is being seen in Europe over the Telstar satellite. Let's give all the baseball fans in Europe a big hello from Chicago.
Back, back. That's it! That's it! Hey! He did it! 30 bank! Got number 500!
It's a no-hitter! It's a no-hitter for Kenny Holtzman!
Here's a shot deep to left. Way back! Kiss it! Goodbye! And it looked like the mailman got it.
Very cool. I think if you Surratt Brickhouse tribute essay, something like that, you can see what Bob Vorwald put together about Jack Brickhouse. That was when WGN-TV was celebrating their 100th, I think. And it's kind of fun to relive those memories, isn't it?
It totally is. You know, and you go back and you think about the Tribune coverage way back then. They were marking that, you know, that they couldn't see the players and the cameras weren't finding the balls. And so you think about how far it's come to this moment where we just, you know, appreciate our live sports. And
yep.
Really cool.
Can't believe it's been, what, almost 30 years since we lost Mike Royko, who we still appreciate big time around here.
Yeah, I know. I was a big fan of his. I know you were, Bob, followed him religiously. Maybe a lot of your listeners did as well. But this week, the city lost Mike Royko, April 28th, 1997. Final column just before he died was actually about the Cubs. He was a loyal fan. You know, he was right there with you, just kind of frustrated about not making it to the championship and wrote about it often. But this week he wrote about how the Cubs curse should be attributed to not a goat, but the team's management. And he fired off one of his Royko type style essays about how we have to go way back to Philip Wrigley if we wanted to look at to see what's wrong with the Cubs, that the poor decision making goes all the way back there. And he says that I think that the headline was, it was Wrigley himself, not some goat, who cursed the Cubs. And we pulled some precious audio from April 1987, Mike Royko at a Cubs game. He walked up, took a seat in the broadcast booth, and he had something on his mind, Bob. He wanted to talk about how professional players were getting paid too much. And here's a little bit of that clip in the broadcast booth at Wrigley.
You know, I think ball players, as entertainers, should be as paid as much as they can get. If they sell tickets and bring in money, fine. I've never objected to how much they get. But I think when you set a guy up virtually for life in some of these cases, you can't be sure that he's going to go out and work as hard. Most people work on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. And in the old days, ball players had to negotiate a new contract every year. And they felt, I got to produce. And there have been so many cases shown where they don't produce once they get these long-range contracts. contracts. And it's understandable. These are young guys, and, you know, they can look down the line and say, I don't have to work again.
Blue collar, always.
Always. Isn't that true? Sticking up for the little guy, and there you go. Sounding off in the broadcast booth.
Yeah, here's some broadcast booth history when Bill Murray was sitting in for Harry.
Do you remember this, Bob? I pulled this, and I was just laughing, like, hysterically. It was so funny. It was the time, the Harry for a day, because Harry had had a stroke, and so they had several, you know, well-known people sit in for Harry Carey. This week, 1987, after Bill Murray stepped into the broadcast booth, and it was, the results were pretty outrageous. We know Harry was known for telling some pretty unusual, sometimes outrageous stories, but Bill Murray took it to a whole new level. A take-no-prisoners critique of the players and the game, the opposing team mostly, and I think you'll appreciate this clip, Bob.
I'm here today to turn this around, and I think with the help of the overrated and not such a big deal after all, Montreal Expos, the Cubs will triumph today, a beautiful day, here at the true Wrigley Building at the corner of Clark and Addison. Starting for the Expos in left field, Casey Kendall. He's no good. In right field is Mitch Webster. He's no good. Frankly, I love the O Canada national anthem because there's only like 10 words to it, and I wish they'd let me sing it. It's one of the goofiest national anthems I've ever heard. It makes the national anthem of the United States sound like Beethoven's Ninth. It's just ridiculous. They've only got 5 words in the song, and they just keep saying them over and over again. And I hope you Canadian folks call up and say something to whoever's in charge in your country about that theme song here.
Yeah, he's no good. Love that.
Caller on line 4. We got another one. Person coming in about, can you imagine the number of Canadians that called into the Wrigley management?
Yeah, they don't want to hear that now, especially. That's, that's the soundtrack of Gene and Georgettis, isn't it, Anna?
I'm sure they've played that song there a couple of times over the years. And that's right, Bob. They, you know, when Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack came to town and Frank wanted a martini and a steak, he'd head over to Gene and Georgettis, which celebrates a milestone this week in 1938. That's when Italian immigrant Gene Michelotti married his young bride, Ida. And 2 years later, they'd open up Gene and Georgettis. Georgetti coming from his chef. That was the nickname for his chef, whose real name was Alfredo. Together, though, they built this iconic restaurant. You think about it, it's positioning right next to the L, just out of downtown, across from the Merchandise Mart. And it was, you know, just the local haunt for local politicians, professionals, and then legends like Frank Sinatra, Bob Hope, Liza Minnelli, Lucille Ball. They'd stop by Gene and Georgettis, and it was known to have like this great feel, this family feel that was dark and people left you alone. And it had a great steaks and great pastas and great martinis. Frank Sinatra, they say, always requested the round table in the back. And he was just a legendary guy and helped build the legend of this local establishment. 80 years later, still there, still family owned, same family. And it is, in fact, Bob, the oldest family run restaurant in Chicago.
Yeah, still great. A lot of people were very nervous when Gene's son-in-law, Tony DuPretti, passed away last year. Mm-hmm. But happy to report the place is still as great as ever. It's time mm-hmm. for equal time for the White Sox now. Let's talk about what Paul Konerko did.
Okay, this was a fun one. April 11th, 2000, Bob, Paul Konerko hit an inside-the-park home run. Fans will remember this, perhaps. Perhaps Paul, some said, was the slowest player ever to do that. It was just kind of a strange series of events that led to this happening. The Tribune at the time reported it was the top of the first inning. Paul Konerko hit a deep drive to left center field that struck the wall in an unusual spot, causing it to ricochet and then left the entire outfield scrambling for the ball. So turned out to be an inside the park home run. And you can hear from the call here, a bit of a shock that Konerko himself was able to pull this off.
A long drive left center field by Konerko. This one is hit hard and deep, and it is high off the wall, and it's in play. Coming around, Magly Ordóñez is going to score. Konerko for third. He's being waved around. Stalker's relay to the plate. Too late, and inside the park home run for Konerko. I didn't believe
believe I would ever see that from Paul Konerko.
Farmer and Rooney were surprised, and so was Konerko, wasn't he?
Konerko was too. Years later, Bob, there's an interview of him I just was reading where he said, I tell people to this day that I did that, and they don't believe me because they've seen me run. And so he did it, and sometimes people forget that he did it. But
yeah.
Fun moment.
And finally, if you can't be in Italy, you can always go to Niles, can't you?
This always, you know, just kind of struck me as a kid growing up in the city when you would pass by the Leaning Tower of Niles. And it's just this cool structure. And you sometimes, if you don't know it, you wonder what's the history there. This week, April 2019, the National Park Service placed a local landmark status on the Leaning Tower of Niles on the National Register of Historic Places. Have you been to it, Bob? Have you been up to it, up in it?
No, I've driven by many times, though.
Me too. Yeah, it's funny. I haven't either. Apparently, they were giving tours up to the top, and you know, you could really kind of take in its history and that kind of thing. But it is truly a half-size, near-exact replica of the actual Leaning Tower of Pisa in Italy, and it just sort of stands out there on a busy street among strip malls and things like that at 6300 West Tui. So this businessman named Robert Ilg had built a 22-acre park way back in the 1920s, and he had these two giant outdoor water tanks built, but he wanted to preserve the beauty of the landscape and the acreage, and so he said, I need to build something in order to obscure them. And so he decided to build the Leaning Tower of Niles, as he named it. And it was just this sight to see. It made took a lot of people by surprise at the time, but people loved it. And in 1960, his family donated it, part of the park, to the YMCA, and it became known as the Leaning Tower YMCA. 20 or so years later, the village of Niles established a sister city pact with Pisa, Italy, which kind of makes sense. And still doing some reconstruction, but I'm told that there may, in fact, be tours again up to the top of the Leaning Tower of Niles. So if you want to put that on your life checklist, you can go ahead and do that. It might be possible.
Yeah, if you can't get to Italy, you head over to 6300 West Tui, check out the Leaning Tower there, and then you go down the street to Papa Chris's place to get a great Italian beef. There you go.
I thought you were going to say that, Bob. That's the perfect day you just outlined there.
It is for me. Thanks, Anna. Talk to you next week. Wednesday.